This episode of Behind the Headlines includes some language that listeners may find offensive. It also includes discussions around mental illness. If you find yourself impacted by these discussions, please do speak with someone you trust and seek out relevant medical support.
Hello, welcome to the Behind the Headlines podcast with me, John Crowley.
And me, Hannah Storm. In these podcasts, we'll be talking to journalists, many of them household names, about the stories they've covered and their own stories as well. We'll hear from them about how our industry is adapting to the realisation that it needs to take conversations around mental health more seriously and how journalism can shape and normalise conversations around well-being.
Hannah and I are both directors of Headlines Network and long-time journalists. Journalists aren't robots. They face pressures either because of the stories they cover or the situations they find themselves in. But what happens when we look behind the headlines and see journalists as humans and learn from their personal stories?
For this episode, we've been speaking with Bryony Gordon, the award-winning journalist who, alongside an incredibly successful work life, has shared candidly her experiences of mental ill health in newspaper columns, podcasts and several best-selling books. Hi, Bryony. We're really delighted you can join us. You're right in the middle of training for a hugely impressive feat of running 100 kilometres over 10 days to raise money for mental health. Tell us a bit more about it.
Oh, God. I mean, yes, it's a bit mad, but I'm going to run 10Ks in 10 days in 10 different ways. And someone was like, oh, why all of those numbers? And I'm like, because it just sounded good. But it's to show that exercise is for everyone. So I don't know about you, Hannah, but when I... you know, we're a similar age. And for me, exercise at school, like my earliest memories of exercise were like, you have to be the fastest or the strongest or the best, or you just didn't do it. And what I have discovered much later on in life, and the thing that really transformed my relationship with exercise, was doing it for the gains and not the losses. So it wasn't about making myself quicker or smaller or stronger. It was about the clarity that the exercise gave me, and it has really transformed my mental health to the point that six years ago I set up something called Mental Health Mates, which is a peer support organization that network around the country, which runs walks for people with mental health issues where they can come together, get out of the house when they just feel that, you know, they need that extra nudge. So I really wanted to do something to raise money to help support the walk leaders, but also just to show that, yeah, exercise is for everyone, because I'm like a size 18 and I'm not fast by any stretch of the imagination, but I really love it. And every day I'm going to do one with a different person. So I'm doing one with a friend of mine who has secondary breast cancer, a doctor called Dr. Amit Patel, who is visually impaired. He's going to leave his guide dog at home and I'm going to guide him, which I'm a little bit kind of anxious about. David Weir, the Paralympian, I'm going to do one with him. And Adele Roberts, who's a Radio 1 DJ who got diagnosed with bowel cancer last October. And then I'm going to do one with a Mental Health Mates group, and we're just going to, and some of them are going to walk, you know, because it's like I just want to kind of say, look, anyone can do this, but I'm 2 days off starting.
It's so inspiring. And my God, when you were talking then about school, cross country,
oh,
I don't know if you have a memory of cross country and like the red face that I used to, I've got ginger hair, red face, awful shorts, always last, feeling rubbish. I run marathons now, and actually you're right, it can be for everybody. It doesn't matter about the time, but it's just about taking part. And for me, as you say, same with you, running has been just like this massive benefit to my mental health and a really interesting way of kind of just having a bit of time to myself and for myself as well. But I just want to ask you there about the you were talking about being a size 18. You have used social media quite extensively to promote body positivity. Tell us a little bit more about why that's so important to you.
I think that I've got sick of feeling judged for the way I looked the whole time. It's really weird. It was like I always felt, even when I was a smaller size, do you know what I mean? I always felt really ashamed of my body or the way I looked. There was always something, which I think is a very kind of common female experience. And there was a certain point, and I can't quite, and it was kind of when I started to get well, it was when I kind of sobered up and stuff. I was so sick of being ashamed of myself. People often say to me, Hannah, like, oh, I wish I had your confidence. And I'm like, I don't have any confidence. Confidence is a trick. It doesn't really exist. But what I do have is a desire to not hate myself anymore, if that makes sense. And I'm like, I just want to get out there and do things without feeling any shame, if that makes sense. So, but it's all, like, there's never been any kind of like solid plan. I wasn't like, when I grew up, I want to run a marathon in my underwear, size 18. Or it's just like these kind of crazy ideas have come up and I've run with them, pardon the pun.
Bryony, it's lovely to be speaking to you here. You said you talked there about founding Mental Health Mates several years ago. What was the motivation behind it? And how pleased are you with how successful it has been?
So the motivation, I mean, was really desperation, John. So like, I knew irrationally that there were other people out there like me who suffered from OCD and all of this other stuff. But I'd never met anyone who admitted, well, like, as it turns out, I had met loads of people that had it, but they just didn't admit to it because obviously there's shame attached. And I really had this sense. I was like on my local common and I was listening. I was going for like a run walk and I was listening to this podcast about this writer called Carson McCullers, who wrote The Heart is a Lonely Hunter. And she died of alcoholism in her 50s, but they had this like archive audio footage of her. And she said that sometimes it feels like everyone is part of a we except for me. And it kind of stopped me in my tracks. Like that really resonated. And I was like, you know, like you had a we, Carson, you just didn't know how to access that we, you know. And so that was how I remember going home and saying to my husband, I'm going to do like this, because I looked around the common and there were all these people doing exercise collectively, like mums with their buggies, really, there's really mad people that do like the military fitness stuff. But I was like, why is there nothing for the 1 in 4, that statistic that gets bandied around the whole time? And I said to my husband, I'm going to like suggest a walk on a common or in a park for people with mental health issues. And he was like, but what if a load of nutters turn up? And I was like, that's the point. Which I don't know how long I'll be able to tell that joke for before it gets like, I get told, no, that's not appropriate, Bryony. So that's how Mental Health Mate started. Again, there was no like, it was just a desperation to meet other people like me. And to my amazement, like 20 people showed up.
And it's grown from there, hasn't it? It's really just grown massively from there.
Yeah, I mean, I have very little to do with it now. It has central employees who support all the walk leaders across the country and people get in touch and they're trained how to carry out a walk, but also how to support if people need the support. I mean, it is peer support. It's not therapy. I mean, I'm really clear about that. But yeah, it's like amazing. Like I just, the walk leaders are incredible. So I'm, to answer your question, John, I'm thrilled. I would love it to get bigger and bigger, but I also kind of wish ultimately there wasn't a need for it, if that makes sense. Like I wish that there was good enough mental health provision in this country, good enough access to help that you didn't need to have to set up these not-for-profit organisations. But we are where we are and we do our best.
It's so striking hearing you talking about that, because I mean, I've had PTSD myself, and kind of just there have been moments where, I mean, you mentioned shame a few times there. You mentioned kind of this idea of isolation. We feel so alone, you know, we feel so alone and isolated in this. And actually, like we're the first person ever to experience this. And actually, it's amazing to hear you say that, because actually, when I started talking about my experiences, it was just extraordinary how many people came back to me and said, this really resonates. We might not have PTSD, we might have anxiety, depression, OCD, but it really resonates to hear somebody else talking about their experiences.
Yeah, and I'm really sorry you've experienced that, Hannah. But you know, like you're right. Like the thing I say that all mental health issues have in common, from anxiety to depression to psychosis and beyond, you know, because there's a gamut of stuff, is that they work by isolating you. They lie to you. They tell you you're alone. They tell you you're a freak. And they tell you that there's no one out there who's going to understand what you're going through. And that's just bollocks. I don't know if I can say that word, but I just said it. You know, not only is there someone out there who understands what you're going through, there's probably someone out there going through what you're going through. So the moment that you can sort of pierce that, prove that lie wrong, you know, you're not immediately cured, but you are on the road to recovery, I think. And it's why I think the last 2 years have been particularly detrimental to mental health, because we have had sort of state sanctioned isolation and we've had that permission to be alone in our heads. But that's probably another podcast altogether.
No, I mean, actually, it's a really good point. I think, you know, we'd like to talk to you a little bit about the kind of last 2 years, because I think there are so many, in some ways, for some people, it's been helpful to their mental health, right? Because there's a sense of, you know, you have more control potentially over what you've had in the past because you're at home by yourself, and maybe you can control certain things. Like, I used to avoid a lot of things, and when I was during COVID, I didn't have to go out and avoid the things that I would have avoided pre-COVID. Yet at the same time, as you say, it's been incredibly isolating. On the kind of question around COVID, how have you found new ways to cope, and what's your kind of thought about how much it's impacted? And I guess that's two kind of questions: how much it's impacted people.
Well, I want to start by talking about what you were just saying about you would avoid things, and in a way it may have improved people's mental health. I think, and you know, it was really interesting because when it started, I had that sense of relief as well. My diary isn't full. I don't have to go and do all these things I essentially don't like doing because, you know, who wants to? And actually, I realized that all of those things that I try to avoid doing in my daily life were actually the things that kept me a little bit sane. Does that make sense? So, like, you know, we talk about in mental health, you talk about, like, lots of people do exposure therapy, for example. So forcing yourself to be with the thing that makes you feel the anxiety is actually really good for you in the long term. And avoidance is actually, in the long term, detrimental to your mental health, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. So it may feel like it's a comfort, but I realized the thing that was kind of rejoicing at being able to be at home all the time, in my head, it was actually all of my sort of bogeymen, if you see what I mean. Because I call my like OCD and my alcoholism, I call it like Jareth the Goblin King, after the David Bowie character in Labyrinth. And I was like, Jareth can kind of like get spread out in my frontal lobe now without anything challenging his supremacy, if you see what I mean. So I think that actually in the long term, it's just been really bad for, I mean, certainly it's been really bad for me. I've got through it, and I've, you know, I'm really grateful that before the pandemic hit, I had lots of support network in place. So I'm sober. I do a 12-step fellowship. So that undeniably, you know, that was very crucial to kind of to keeping connected with Zoom meetings and so on and so forth. And, you know, forcing myself outside. You know, I hear so often, I think it's Johan Hari in his book Lost Connections, I think it's about a book about addiction, and he points out that connection is the opposite of addiction. And I think that's a really crucial sort of thing to remember. Like, we are, as humans, we need each other, if that, you know, and actually this is great, it's fantastic that we can do this stuff on Zoom, but for me there is nothing like actually sitting in a room with people and being able to touch them, not in like a pervy way.
In your new book, it's called No Such Thing as Normal, you say that when you were young, you were convinced that the world was going to end. So when the pandemic struck, it was kind of a bit of a walk in the park compared to all the shit that had happened in your brain previously. To what extent have you seen people reframing flaws, if you like, as superpowers?
Yeah, I was like, look, guys, the world is ending. And that level of anxiety that everyone was suddenly feeling certainly felt very normal to me. It was like constant feeling from a very young age. So, yeah, so I had this strength that I had previously thought of as a weakness, if you see what I mean. I think what's happened in the last 2 years is the pandemic has kind of forced us to, it's confronted us with our lives and maybe all that kind of stuff that we were trying to ignore. I'm not sure this is even answering your question, but anything we might have been trying to ignore has like come full throttle, right? So I have a lot of friends who have made really big life decisions, be it in career or in their families or, you know, and I don't think that's like a coincidence.
So you just mentioned there Jareth the Goblin in your book. Tell us more about this, where you're almost personifying that kind of devil on your shoulder almost, which is telling you that you're doing all this wrong. Tell us more about that.
Well, Jareth, yeah. I remember I had like a therapist at one point who was like, why don't you give your OCD a name? And I don't know where Jareth the Goblin King, because I don't think I'd watched Labyrinth for many years, but I always remember Jareth the Goblin King, the David Bowie character, being like, evil but ever so slightly enticing, which really kind of summed up my relationship with OCD. And I don't know, it's like being able to give it this personality, it almost has less power over me, because I can sort of have, when I feel my OCD coming back, I can be like, you know, sod off, Jareth. It sounds mad, but it gives it less power, you know, if I see it as an entity that I can sort of try and control or put to sleep. Like, I accept he's never going away, do you know what I mean? But like, if I don't know, and I also think it helps to kind of, it sort of gives it also, like, listen, having a mental illness is hideous, it's horrible, and there's something empowering and sort of like light about giving it a name, you know, like a silly name, I don't know, that perhaps is otherwise absent in your life, you know, when you're suffering.
Yeah, you're kind of belittling it, aren't you, by saying it as well, like if you're making it ridiculous. I watched it recently actually with my family, and he is super creepy. I don't think pass muster. I don't think the film would be released, this kind of overly sexual David Bowie hitting on a young girl.
A 16-year-old girl.
Yeah.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
Let's talk about journalism, because we haven't really spoken about that yet. Do you feel, you know, when it comes to mental health and well-being, that the journalism industry has changed its attitude enough over the years? That might be a leading question.
I was just going to say, actually, just going to butt in there. Just, I mean, thinking back about your first book, Bryony, The Wrong Knickers, when I was reading it, and we're a similar age, as we said, you know, I found myself nodding along, because all the three of us joined journalism in the kind of the similar period of time in the 90s. And it was like, my God, some of the behaviours we were conditioned to accept. So maybe that's a kind of segue into, in the last 25 years or whatever, have things changed? Have they changed enough? What have we been conditioned to accept, and what kind of behaviours are we still embarking on that perhaps are not as good as they might be?
Well, I've changed. I don't know about the journalism, the sector as a whole, because I can't speak. I don't, you know, I work for one organisation, do you know what I mean? So it's hard for me to kind of generalise. I think, you know, it's also very hard for me to extrapolate from my experience, because I appreciate that the way I am treated is different, because I speak so openly about my mental health. So it's like my mental health campaigning is like my career. So if I, you know, when I had to say to my editors, I need time off back in 2017 because I had to go to rehab, they were incredibly supportive of me. Do you know what I mean? Now, I'm not saying that they wouldn't be supportive of other people, but like I can only speak for my own experience. And generally speaking, when I have lots of friends who are journalists, I think any industry can be unhealthy. I have a sense the more well I get that I write a lot about mental health, but I don't always work in a mentally healthy way, if that makes sense. And certainly over the years I haven't, you know, and that's okay. But it's like recognizing it. Like, I think, you know, there was certainly in the 90s, the noughties, a big drinking culture in journalism, which I definitely see has gone away. Like, I don't think that young people now in journalism booze as much as you know, I mean, certainly even before I started, you know, that culture of like the long lunch, like that doesn't happen anymore, right? And I think people have had to get, you know, it's you can't really survive in this world as an organization if you are not being amenable to people's mental health. You just can't, you know, because you'll get found out. But yeah, I do look back at certainly some of the situations I found myself in as a young journalist, or the scrapes I got into, the, you know, it was like there was a lot of dysfunction was normalized, I would say. I don't know, like, was that your experience? I can imagine it. John, was it your?
Well, we certainly had a drink or two together in the past. I think what you've done, Bryony, is you've spoken very honestly and expansively about it. Hannah was just saying there, you know, in The Wrong Knickers, about your episodes with drug taking, sex and addictions. I mean, I guess that's one question that we haven't asked yet, that moment of actually doing it, of writing the book, of kind of talking really honestly about your mental health, how big a hurdle was that for you to do?
It wasn't really, because it's weird, like I had to do it because it was like a sort of, again, it was out of desperation. And I'm looking back, because I first wrote about my OCD and the type of OCD I had in my column in the Sunday Telegraph in Stella. And, you know, looking back, what I was writing at the time, it was pretty, like, I'm really amazed actually that they printed it, because it was quite dark. And if you have this thing, like I do, please come and let me know, so I know I'm not mad, or I am mad and that's okay, but I'm not bad. And that was the moment, and I was like 2014 maybe, that I got just a huge response from Telegraph readers. Massive. Like, I've never written anything that has had quite that response. And that was when I realised it was really, really normal to feel weird. So it wasn't, I guess it was a leap of faith, but it was a necessary thing. And I, you know, very much my recovery has, I really do think, been for better or for worse, has happened because of my work and my journalism. Do you know what I mean? Like, the two are so deeply entwined. It's very hard to separate them, if that makes sense.
It makes a lot of sense. I mean, I think that, you know, I've read a quote somewhere where you've previously said that I found sharing isn't just about entertaining people, it's become a way of surviving. And the fact that you just said then, you know, it's normal to be or feel weird. I think that, tell us more about this idea that it's not just the entertainment, it is actually about survival.
I don't think I ever thought, I mean, maybe that subconsciously that was what I was doing. Let's turn this like horrible stuff into funny anecdotes, do you know what I mean? To amuse people, because I mean, maybe there was a bit of that, but really it was, I had this platform where I was writing about my life and, you know, my boyfriends or my pathetic love life or whatever. And it just kind of, well, no, I think by then I was married and had a kid, but you know, all that silly old briny, I'm always slightly messing up. Woohoo, is it just me? The background to this was these breakdowns that I would have like every 2 years, really, that I had since I was 11 or 12. And I just was like, this can't just be me. This just cannot just be me. Do you know what I mean? Like, this, I knew, as I said, I knew intellectually that other people had this type of OCD that I had, but I didn't. This is what I'm doing. This is my job, writing about my life. But why have I never written about this really big part of my life, you know, because I felt the shame and the stigma. And it was really a like, come and find me moment. And it changed my life completely, like completely. And it was not in the plan at all, you know, like the stuff that, but being able to like use journalism as a tool to connect with people. I mean, that's what journalism is really, isn't it? Do you know what I mean? In a nutshell. But when you're personally using it to kind of connect, it sort of expanded into all sorts of things, like that starting the podcast and asking Prince Harry. You know, now he does interviews all the time. But back in 2017, it was like the first interview he'd done about this kind of stuff. And, you know, like using journalism as a tool to kind of connect with people and let people know that it was okay, if that makes sense.
Two-tier question, because as you were saying, this really had an impact with people. You were breaking the mold. Did anyone at work just check if you were okay? Because obviously traffic's flowing in, you're really popular. Did they check in on you? And secondly, do you now feel a kind of responsibility to your audience, to your readers?
Did anyone at work? Yes, I don't. I've always been very looked after, checked in on. But I think because I've been quite, once I'd come out about it, I was quite good at checking in myself as well. Do you know what I mean? Like, there was never that kind of like, we need to check in on Bryony, because if there was something wrong, I felt very easily able to say it. A responsibility to my readers. I just started about 4 months ago a column specifically on about mental health. So the world viewed through the prism of mental health. So, and I think that to me was more about kind of being more focused and being able to really highlight what is available, what isn't, why it isn't, what can we do about it to make it more available, like communicate with people, because I get so many letters, emails from people telling me about their struggles to access provision that I really wanted, you know, heartbreaking stuff that just shouldn't happen. So I wanted to do something a bit more specific that wasn't just every now and then I do a column on mental health, do you know what I mean? And then the next week, oh, could we have a light column on, I don't know what, I'm trying to think off the top of my head, do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, some celebrity interview. This is a commitment.
Yeah.
And that's what No Such Thing as Normal is about, as well as the book, because there isn't that provision out there for people to, you know, people don't know what to do.
No.
Sometimes in terms of access to mental health.
Especially now, right? Especially now after 2 years of COVID. I mean, we've been talking about mental health provisions and we've seen just this desperate need on people's behalf for mental health support during COVID as well.
No Such Thing as Normal. Like, I spent a lot of time interviewing people at the, like, working on the front line of mental health services in the UK, from you know, from therapists and people in psychosis services through to like paramedics. And what was the, and I really wanted to kind of simplify what was available and what, you know, because I think we hear so much about how bad mental health services are, but that isn't in itself very helpful when you're in crisis, you know. And I think the more that we intuitively know what is available and how to access it, the more that the powers that be will know that they need to increase the provision of it, if you see what I mean. So it sort of is a bit of a vicious cycle, whatever, do you know what I mean, at the moment, because it doesn't, you know, people don't know what to ask for. And because they don't know what to ask for, we don't know the full scale of the problem. Although I'm sure many people working in the services are, you know, very able to point to the scale of the problem. So just in the same way that we know that if, like, a child has my daughter has a fever for a couple of days in a row, I will take her to pediatric A&E or whatever, do you know what I mean? Like, you know, we just know what to do, right? But that is not the case with mental health.
Do you think it's about sensitizing people, therefore, to kind of the words and the language through journalism? But also, I mean, you know, I was going to ask you about taboos. I mean, there's a lot of taboo still, isn't there, around mental health? But actually, is it partly the responsibility of us as journalists to try to tackle those taboos as well, to try to talk about things like suicide, for instance, to talk about words that people kind of sometimes find a bit icky?
Yes, absolutely. Talk about suicide responsibly. I know that for a long time, the Samaritans had a really hard time with getting newspapers, editors to use the responsible suicide language. So we try not to say commit suicide, because it was a crime until 1961. So it sort of adds that stigma to it. So we'd say complete suicide or die by suicide. But there was a long time, there was a real resistance to that, apparently, because people were like, we don't want to be told how to write, or we don't want to be told what's in the newspaper, which you totally get. In 2018, I did a campaign with Luciana Berger, who at the time was a Labour MP, to sort of try and, you know, to kind of hammer that stuff through. And again, it was amazing. Even then, we had response in terms of, we got huge amount, you know, loads of very high profile names signed the letter, but we had very little response from editors, not just at newspapers, but at news organisations, you know. And I think that there is a lot of talking the talk in the media, but there isn't, but I don't think this is just the media. I think this is organizations generally. There's a lot of talking the talk with mental health, but not very much walking the walk. I can tell you the number of times that I'm called in, like I'm asked to go and do a talk at some bank or something, right? Like, about mental health, or a big, you know, city organization. And then you'll get a message the next day on Instagram from someone who was in the audience, who will be like, thank you for your talk. I just need you to know that this company is appalling when it comes to looking after its employees' mental health. But that is, you know, that you hear that widely. And I think we're still at that stage, aren't we, where it's, you know, we need to get people to walk the walk more.
I mean, and that's one of the reasons why we set up Headlines Network, because John and I kept colliding on panels and talking about talking and talking and talking. And actually, there was less of the doing going on. But I was just picking up on a point you mentioned before about privilege. you know, you've spoken about your privilege as a white woman speaking out about your mental health. And this is something I felt as well, you know, as a straight white woman. And also, you know, you mentioned before Prince Harry, a really, you know, important person with a huge amount of privilege. How do we square this notion of people with privilege speaking about their mental health while often it's those who are much less privileged who are really struggling?
Well, we speak to everyone. You know, like, I have always made sure that Mad World, that podcast, yeah, Prince Harry's was our first guest, but I don't have a Prince Harry style guest each week. Do you know what I mean? We have teenage girls who have been sectioned, people really at that other edge, you know, the other side. And that's what I wanted it to be, is an inclusive podcast that covers everybody's experience, because this is a universal problem. Now, of course, it is a bigger problem if you don't have many of the privileges that I have. I always am very honest about how lucky I am in terms of the resources that I have had at my disposal, you know. And if it's tough for me with that, like, what the fuck is it like for, you know, other people who don't have that? So I always see I am in a privileged position. And it is absolutely imperative that that position is used to highlight the injustices that exist, if that makes sense, for less privileged people. Because otherwise, there's no point doing it.
Makes a lot of sense. Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't, you know, like, I can really beat myself up with a privilege stick, and I think it's easy. A lot of us can do that, you know, like checking our privilege and going, oh, I'm a bad person because I've had it all handed to me on a plate in comparison and da 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 da. And it's like, that's not what it's about, is it? It's about like going, okay, so how are we going to share this, you know, with people? How are we going to make the world a more equal place?
Bryony, it's been lovely speaking to you today. We ask all our guests for one piece of advice for our listeners on how they manage their mental health. What would your one piece of advice be?
Connect, 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 connection, connection, connection. Do the thing your brain tells you don't want to do. Like, get outside, connect with people, even when you don't want to, especially when you don't want to. Yeah. So like, mental illness often it's an illness. Well, mental illnesses, they tend to tell you don't have them and that you're being silly or that you're being dramatic or you're being whatever. It's really important to know that often our brains will lie to us. You know, they're not telling the truth. Our brains are not always telling the truth. That was not one piece of advice. That was like 800 pieces of advice rolled into one.
But it was all about connection. And it's been really, really lovely to, you know, it sounds incredibly trite to say, it's been lovely to connect with you, Bryony. I wish it was in person. I really do.
Oh my God, I literally have spent the last 2 years in my own head waddling around like, oh, what am I doing? You know, like, but even just doing like a Zoom like this, I'm like, oh yes, this is what we do, you know, like we communicate, we chat. And then I have a buzz for another 20 minutes and then it goes again.
Oh, well, thank you so much and best of luck with your amazing running. It's been a real privilege.
Thank you so much, Bryony.
Isn't it interesting, John, how this idea about connection. The last 2 years have been so difficult for so many people. We've been so disconnected. And yet in journalism, in some ways, we've been hyper-connected. But I think it felt like three of us just kind of connecting at a really kind of human level there, didn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, the way that Bryony has lived her life is example to us all. Whether it's in real life, whether we're in a room or connecting over a Zoom here, it's incredibly important to reach out to people. And that goes beyond journalism.
It does. And thank you, John. And I think just this idea of normalising the conversation too, you know, Bryony's book being called No Such Thing as Normal, but yet we've got to normalise the conversation because mental health impacts so many of us. If you liked our podcast, we'd love you to leave a comment wherever you listen. And we look forward to welcoming you next time for another episode of Behind the Headlines.